Welcome to another episode of the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. A progressive insight into Michigan's political and cultural world. And of course, an entertaining podcast designed to shine a light on how to make Michigan's political machine work for the people. Now, from the Left of Lansing headquarters, located in his attic, here's the award-winning Pat Johnston.
Oh, yeah! Welcome to another installment of Michigan's premier progressive podcast. I am Pat Johnston, and are you really, honestly surprised by the cowardly acts of MAGA Michigan congressmen like John James and Tom Barrett as they repeatedly ignore running town halls in front of their own constituents? I mean, this is the MAGA way. When confronted with the unpopularity of their policies, of course these guys show exactly who MAGA Republicans really are. Bullies without convictions. I mean, what can be said about Tom Barrett, who represents Alyssa Slotkin's former district after she became U.S. Senator? Michigan Advance's Eric Diaz-Veliz reported this week how Barrett was once again a no-show when his constituents demanded some answers from him. The AFL-CIO and NAACP helped organize the event in South Lansing this week, and they were just trying to provide a way for constituents to talk about how Trump and his fellow authoritarian co-president Elon Musk are dismantling the working class as they work to further empower and enrich their own elite, untouchable class. Diaz-Veliz reported in Michigan Advance that while several Democratic and Republican Michigan politicians were invited to the event, it was attended in person by only five Democratic lawmakers, State Representatives Julie Brixby, Kara Hope, Jennifer Conlin, Sam Singh, and Emily Devendorf. That's all a great job, by the way, of all those state reps to attend. And let me say just a quick shout out to our good friend Emily Devendorf for being there, which of course Devendorf would be there because the future of the working class of their constituents is at stake. You'd think that Tom Barrett would want to attend just for that very reason. But no, the dismantling of Social Security and Medicaid by Dear Leader Trump and Co-President Musk, and also the MAGA Republican Congress, were on the tops of Tom Barrett's constituents' minds, and that's why he didn't want to show up. He didn't want to hear all of that. He didn't want to hear what he probably views as whining and complaining of the working class in his district. And the people there also wanted to talk about deportations and the disappearance of immigrants, tax cuts for the donor class and the corporate donor class. You know, I love this quote from that Michigan Advance story. It says, quote, "We're the ones paying their salaries. They live off our taxes, so they should represent us. But as you can see, Tom Barrett isn't here. That's just wrong," said Lorenzo Lopez, a Lansing activist and resident. You see, the people in these MAGA Republican districts throughout Michigan and the rest of the nation are really starting to get it. And they're getting how these MAGA Republicans like Tom Barrett don't believe they serve the people in their district. No, they believe they serve their corporate donors, their corporate masters, and of course, the leader of the corporate authoritarian class, Dear Leader Trump. That's who they serve. They serve him, not the people they supposedly represent. And then there's Congressman John James, oh yeah, who really isn't doing anything for the working class in the 10th Congressional District, but that's not shocking. James, you see, is a figurehead who's just there to protect Dear Leader and his incompetent and corrupt regime. Have you heard John James say one negative thing at all about Dear Leader? Just one. I mean, I'm told we live in a purple state, so John James should be at times criticizing Dear Leader Trump. All the times I'm hearing the Lansing political machinery, the Lansing media elites out there telling us how Democrats have to always reach across the aisle because we live in a purple state. But you never, ever hear them say the same thing about Republicans. MAGA Republicans never have to abide by the same rules that Democrats supposedly have to adhere by. So where was John James? John James is never there. He was once again a no-show for a town hall this week, but give lots of credit. All right, everybody, give lots of credit to progressive Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, who showed up at that town hall event in Macomb County. Tlaib shows up for the people, so that's not really a surprise to me and to many of you listening. And guess what? She stayed there for 2 hours at that town hall, answering questions for the people who attended the event. She was answering the questions that John James was supposed to show up and answer. Rashida Tlaib fights on behalf of the working class in her district and for the everyday folks in Michigan who can't afford lobbyists to speak on their behalf in Lansing and Washington. Congresswoman Tlaib highlighted John James's support to gut over $800 million in Medicaid spending, which affects millions of Michigan, including children, which, you know, I thought the pro-life crowd like John James was all about protecting. Oh, right. Those Christian nationalists aren't really following the words and teachings of Jesus. I forgot. It's about punishing kids and punishing their moms while cutting basic needs and services as they force women to give birth. Oh, and by the way, one in five Michiganders could be forced from nursing home care. But as we know full well, people like Musk and his fellow tech bros view older Americans as a waste on their resources, on the country's resources. That's why they want to gut Social Security. That's why they want to raise retirement age. Because to them, if they ain't working, it's time to put them out to pasture and get someone in there who'll work for their corporate rulers and work for them until death. Work till death. Work till death. Isn't that a great campaign slogan? And remember, everyone, this is the guy, dear leader, and MAGA Republicans will most likely back to be the party's candidate as Michigan's next governor. That's why they're backing John James. And how can John James represent all of Michigan if he's afraid to appear in front of his own district's constituents? Maybe it's because he's not only a coward, but maybe it's also that he knows he can't justify gutting Social Security while supporting massive corporate tax cuts. These MAGA Republicans have no shame, and they have no guts to stand up for their beliefs, whatever they are. I think that's the worst part about them ignoring their voters. They can't defend their own policies, like fighting for additional tax cuts for corporations as those corporations gouged us well after the pandemic, or, you know, like fighting to gut Medicaid and Social Security while dear leader's reckless tariffs lead us off an economic cliff. Maybe that's why John James is too afraid to face the voters. Oh, by the way, though, I did see this. There is a little rumbling out there from some in the MAGA Republican sphere that maybe now would be a good time to actually levy some taxes on the multimillionaire and billionaire class. Now, don't get your hopes up. I mean, there's no way the MAGA Republican leadership in Congress would ever do such a thing, but it shows how AOC and Bernie Sanders' anti-oligarchy rallies are really resonating with the people, and it is scaring the hell out of some MAGA Republicans. I'll have more on that in my last call later on. And, you know, for those who believed in people like Dear Leader Trump or John James or Tom Barrett, if you really believe that they were your populist buddies, your populist pals, especially my Gen Z friends out there, well, listen to this. The Education Department, headed by Trump's pick, Linda McMahon of the WWF or WWE, whatever it is, they announced that they will begin the debt collection process on student loans that are in default. And according to the Associated Press, that will include garnishment of wages for millions of borrowers. Isn't that going to be just lovely? Isn't that going to be nice? And it's brought to you by the same people who told you that feminism and a couple of trans kids playing high school sports was more important to your life than your ability to get rid of your student debt and thereby joining America's economy. Now, I will say that I've had many disagreements with the Biden administration, but you have to call them like you see them. And Biden did some good things, or at least tried to do some good things. For example, Biden's administration utilized tariffs, but it utilized targeted tariffs against certain industries or countries like China. It had something called, let's see, a strategy. I think it's also called a real economic plan and a real tariff plan, rather than using tariffs as a personal slush fund, which is exactly what Dear Leader is doing. And another thing that Biden tried to do was eliminate the student debt of millions of students. But yet it didn't happen because the MAGA Supreme Court majority blocked it. By the way, the AP reports that some 5.3 million Americans are defaulting on their loans, and an additional 4 million are late on their loans. And MLive reports that starting on May 5th, the Treasury Department will begin using its offset program to collect money owed for student loans. Now, this program allows the Treasury to withhold government payments like tax refunds, federal salaries, and other benefits in order to settle past due debts to the government. Hey, ask yourselves, everyone, how is this a populist move? MAGA Republicans said that they were the populist party. How is this a populist move? And how does this help students and former students struggling to participate in the nation's economy, an economy being wrecked by Trump and his MAGA Republican sycophants? How does this help the people? I mean, this regime is declaring war on colleges and universities across the land. You'd think, you know what, that maybe they wouldn't mind eliminating the debt that students racked up while becoming all woke and everything, right? Speaking of which, I really hope you got to listen to last week's episode featuring my talk with Julie Powers from Immigration Law and Justice Michigan. And in that episode, we talked about how the regime and the white Christian nationalists within it are targeting international students in Michigan and across the land as a way to attack immigrants and also to attack higher education. And I'll be darned, they're doing exactly what Project 2025 said they would do. That's why the election next year for Michigan's other United States Senate seat is of the utmost importance. By placing a strong progressive voice that will fight back against this authoritarian regime could send shockwaves throughout the land. And here's the thing, the next Michigan senator won't just be a younger voice, because it most definitely could be if the Democrats win, but it could be a voice leading the Democratic Party in Washington into a new direction that'll fight for the working class values and actually inspire and fight back against the MAGA Republican Party that's been beating up Democrats for years. And that's why I was a little baffled this week when I saw that Congresswoman Haley Stevens is jumping into the Democratic primary race for the U.S. Senate seat as she joined progressive Democrats Mallory McMorrill and Abdul El-Sayed. And while the Democratic base has been hungering and thirsting for some new leadership within the party, this is what Haley Stevens had to say about Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer recently on CNN. This was before she announced her run, but still, listen to this quick clip.
You're talking about the party. Well, listen, let me be honest with you. I think Chuck Schumer's a great leader.
Now, look, I'm pretty certain you won't find many lauding Schumer as a great leader here in Michigan or even in his own home state of New York. But that being said, let it never be said that Haley Stevens isn't about New York politics, because let's not forget, she threw her support in 2020 not for Joe Biden, not for Liz Warren, not for Kamala Harris, not for Pete Buttigieg, but for billionaire and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg. That's who Haley Stevens decided was the best person to become the next president of the United States, even more to take on Donald Trump in 2020. Michael Bloomberg? I mean, you guys remember in that very first Democratic primary debate how Senator Warren ended Michael Bloomberg's campaign in less than 60 seconds, right? I mean, here, let's play. This is how she did it.
I'd like to talk about who we're running against. A billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. Democrats are not going to win if we have a nominee who has a history of hiding his tax returns, of harassing women, and of supporting racist policies like redlining and stop and frisk. Look, I'll support whoever the Democratic nominee is. But understand this, Democrats take a huge risk if we just substitute one arrogant billionaire for another.
And this is who Haley Stevens backed for president. She backed Bloomberg over, again, Warren, Biden, Harris, Mayor Pete, and others. You have to question, what kind of political wisdom is that? And Haley Stevens also backed Michael Bloomberg, who helped finance MAGA ring kissers like Lindsey Graham. I don't think Michiganders are in the mood for this kind of inside the beltway politics in which nothing gets done except for the corporate elite. And they're also tired of a Democratic Party that won't fight Republicans, who gladly are assisting dear leader Trump in tearing down the working class and even more our democracy. This is bad judgment by Haley Stevens. those examples right there make me wonder exactly what is Haley Stevens fighting for? What is her angle? Why is she getting in this whole race to begin with? And why do I have the sneaking suspicion that she's being financed by some big money people out there to block any Democratic candidate whose primary mission will be to fight against Republicans and to also fight for the working class? We need fighters in the Senate and someone who's going to move that Overton window back a little bit towards the left. But it seems to me that Stevens appears like that she's comfortable fighting on the center right or even further right on the political scale. Now, State Senator Mallory McMorrow is already attacking the current Democratic Party leadership, and she's already said that she believes that Schumer's got to step down. But Haley Stevens says, let's stick with the status quo. And that's what I've been arguing for some time now when it comes to the party. Democrats, okay, fine. You gain the majority next year in Congress. Fine. Then what? Go back to normal? Well, what is normal as worker rights eroded and wages stagnated and the Supreme Court got more and more radical right wing? What's normal if you get back in the power? This isn't about putting Democrats back in the power. We need substantive change here for the future. Is Haley Stevens the right person for the moment? And hey, of course, Stevens has announced her staunch support for the right-wing government in Israel as it murders thousands in Gaza and, you know, tries to get us into a war with Iran. Look, I'm all for Israel being a country, of course, and naturally they have a right to defend themselves. But not carte blanche killing of innocent women and children. We can be for Israel, but against the extreme and corrupt right-wing government of Israel. You know, it's really not that hard to do. You're seeing Israelis do the same thing. But I'm not getting that kind of common sense from Haley Stevens whatsoever. Bottom line, the one who represents a working-class agenda, one that includes paid sick leave, the expansion of child tax credits, fighting to eliminate student loans, promising to introduce a millionaire and billionaire tax, promising to raise the corporate tax rate back to where it was before Trump's first term, advancing the Pro-Union PRO Act, protecting the freedom of speech on college campuses, and protecting the due process rights of all who are here legally, and also allowing Medicare to negotiate all prescription drug prices. I mean, those would all be a good first step. And the one who represents that kind of agenda, I think here in Michigan, especially in the Democratic primary race, will end up being the victor. Now, one thing I love to hear from all three of these candidates is whether or not they believe the Line 5 oil pipeline ought to be finally shut down. Now, I ask that because last week, the Trump regime suddenly signed an order that will fast-track a tunnel project to cover the 72-year-old Canadian pipeline that's owned by Enbridge. And it happened after Dear Leader declared a few weeks ago, as his tariffs on Canada and Mexico began, that, hey, we didn't need Canada. Yet for some reason, though, Dear Leader wants to help a Canadian oil company continue to send its oil pipeline through the UP, down through the Straits of Mackinac, through portions of the Eastern Lower Peninsula, down to Detroit, and then ending back into Canada? How the hell is that a pro-America agenda? Where's the pro-America crowd on this one? And I did read that Republican State Senator Ed McBroom and Republican State Reps Carl Boniak, Parker Fairbairn, Greg Markkinen, and Dave Preston applauded Trump's decision on the tunnel. Of course, most of these guys, especially Dave Preston, are climate change deniers. But even so, I love to hear how these American First guys are all for a Canadian oil company using Michigan for its own profits. And I say that because, you know, I kind of remember when Trump's tariffs were originally supposed to begin. And I remember how I saw many MAGA supporters attacking Detroit News reporter Chad Livengood because he pointed out how the tariffs would lead to higher gas prices and higher prices of propane for the UP that comes from Line 5. And many MAGA Trump supporters attacked Livengood saying that, hey, guess what? The tariffs are fine with them. Doesn't matter to them because they just use heat pumps and wood stoves, etc. And I found that to be remarkable because I was told for years whenever I brought that kind of stuff up that there weren't enough heat pumps and wood stoves and that we would always need Line 5 for the UP. So which is it, MAGA? But in the end, this whole fast-tracking the tunnel project for Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac is all about corporate greed that endangers our livelihoods here in Michigan, but it's also about paying back a campaign donor for Dear Leader Trump. Coming up to talk more about this latest fast-tracking tunnel development is Jeffrey Insko, who provides updates and historical backgrounds on his site called The Current, which describes this fossil fuel boondoggle that's happening at the expense of all of us here in the state of Michigan. Stay tuned for that. You're listening to LOL.
A podcast devoted to intelligence, sanity, and freedom, or otherwise known as progressive politics. It's Left of Lansing with your host, Pat Johnston. Need to tell Pat where he's wrong? Or do you actually want to praise Pat? Leftoflansing@gmail.com is how to reach him. Here's Pat.
Just want to say a quick thank you to all of you who listened and subscribed to the show wherever you're listening and also on YouTube. You know, I hear a lot of people, including we progressives out there, saying that we need our own messaging machine and our own podcasting lineups out there, not just in Michigan, but throughout the entire country. But I have to tell you, we do have some good ones here in Michigan who are trying to do just that. We've got the Still Social's Point of Disorder show that augments all of their on-the-ground work that they do to help organize a progressive base across Michigan. And while I might not agree with everything said on the podcast known as A Republic, If You Can Keep It, with former Michigan Democratic Party Chair Mark Brewer and former Executive Director of the Michigan Republican Party Jeff Timmer, they do provide another avenue for people looking for some anti-MAGA liberal discussions out there, some sanity, actually, and they do a good job over there as well. So we do have some good people who have been doing some good work in areas where MAGA right-wing corporate authoritarians are not only dominating much of the political echo chamber, but who are also stifling progressive voices from being a part of that echo chamber. And that's why I say it's also up to you guys out there to help spread the word that we are here trying to do just that. So make sure to support all of us who are trying to add a bold progressive voice and vision against this white Christian nationalistic slash tech bro corporate authoritarianism that we are up against. Now, one of those voices in Michigan who's busy writing about a specific kind of corporate power, that being the oil and gas industry and the hold it has here in Michigan and how it continues to use its political power, both in the state and federal government, is joining me here this week. Jeffrey Insko is a writer, author, and English professor at Oakland University. He has a Substack called The Current, in which he provides updates on the battle to shut down the Line 5 oil pipeline that's under the Straits of Mackinac. Now, there's been some news on the Canadian energy company known as Enbridge, which runs the Line 5 pipeline, how the Trump regime is fast-tracking a tunnel project for that 72-year-old pipeline. So I thought it would be a perfect time to invite Mr. Insko here on the show. So Jeffrey, thank you so much for being on this week. I appreciate it.
It is a pleasure to be with you. Thanks so much for having me.
All right. And you live in Michigan, obviously, if you're a professor at Oakland University.
Yes, sir. In fact, I not only live in Michigan, I live on the route of Enbridge's other pipeline, Line 6B, which is right in my backyard.
Oh, OK. Yeah, that's right. Is that how you got kind of involved in wanting to write more about Line 5? Is that because of the experience that you had to deal with?
It is certainly the personal origin of my involvement in these matters. We had a kind of extended up-close encounter with what it means to live through a massive pipeline construction project and deal with a corporation that cared most about getting oil pumping through that line again as fast as they could, as opposed to taking good care of the folks who live all up and down that pipeline. So,
how many years ago was that oil spill in the Kalamazoo River?
So 15 years now.
Has it been that long? Wow. Yep,
we're almost 2 months to the day, 15 years ago. And the replacement project took place a couple of years after the spill, and it took them a couple of years to complete it.
What was that like for you and for others in that area?
It was a long, torturous nightmare. They treated landowners and municipalities with callous disregard. They violated their own policies. They flouted local ordinances in all of this great haste to get a new pipeline installed, because the Pipeline Hazardous Materials Safety Administration, the federal agency that oversees pipelines, had placed restrictions on the operating pressure of that line. And so they couldn't pump at the same volume they had been before the spill. And so they were in a big rush to get this done. And those of us who live on the pipeline bore the brunt of that rush. And lots of people got it, I should say, far, far worse than we did. I simply started speaking up because I was hearing stories from people all up and down the line being mistreated by the company. I wanted to take whatever skills and platforms I had to try and help my neighbors and others along the 210-mile route of that line.
So before that happened, I mean, had you been paying attention to what was going on with the fight to shut down Line 5 beforehand, or did your personal experience sort of get you more involved in what was happening there?
The great question. I mean, the modern, what I would call the modern movement to shut down Line 5 didn't really begin until after the spill. So after the spill in 2010, suddenly there was a great deal of awareness on the activities of these kinds of oil and gas infrastructure systems that exist in our state. And people started sniffing around and kind of discovered what was hidden in plain sight, which is this other pipeline, Line 5. And alarm bells really went off for a lot of folks once they realized that it is, in fact, older than the pipeline that ruptured into the Kalamazoo River. So the movement to shut down the pipeline as it exists today is the direct result of the spill and the aftermath of the spill in 2010.
So, look, I know, obviously, as we've been talking about here, you know, many Michiganders, and especially those who are probably listening to this show, have a good grasp on what Line 5 is all about. But for maybe some who are not completely aware of the issue, and for some listening across the country, could you give just maybe a little background on Line 5, you know, where it runs from and to, and what it transports, and, you know, why it was even built in the first place?
Sure, I'd be happy to. So, I mean, the slightly longer version is that there were refineries going back to the 19th century in Sarnia, Ontario, across the St. Clair River from Port Huron here in Michigan. And during and after World War II, those refinery expansions grew exponentially. And then in the late 40s, there was a major oil discovery way up in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And since the refinery infrastructure already existed, the discoverers of that, they were called Imperial Oil at that time, wanted to get oil from this vast new reserve in the northwestern part of Canada all the way to the east where the refineries and the markets were. And so they built a pipeline, what at that time is the world's longest pipeline, from Edmonton to Superior, Wisconsin. And from there, oil would be shipped by tanker across the Great Lakes down to the refineries in Sarnia. And what they learned very quickly after that began in 1950, what they learned very quickly is that the shipping season, because of ice on the Great Lakes, is quite limited. And so they only had an 8-month season to ship oil. And so the solution to that problem of limited season was to build a new pipeline. And so they built what we now know as Line 5. So it runs from Superior, Wisconsin, all the way across the UP. For folks who have driven Route 2 across the UP east to west, it more or less follows that route. Then when it gets to the Straits of Mackinac, it splits into twin pipelines, which they laid at the bottom of the straits. And then it emerges again on the lower peninsula, heads south toward Sarnia. And that's its termination point. And one thing I would just point out here is that from the very beginning, Line 5 was built to transport Canadian oil to Canadian refineries. And that remains largely true today.
It has to deal also with the kind of oil too, right? That's why it's being refined in Canada. Well, and I guess also in part in Detroit as well, right?
Yes, a portion of that oil gets diverted and goes to the refinery, the Marathon refinery in Detroit. Yeah, that's right. True. It transports crude oil and liquefied natural gas. And, you know, much of that product, some of it's used for jet fuel, some of it is used for gasoline. A significant part of it, which is a thing I think we often don't talk enough about, is feedstock for plastics, which get made at the petrochemical refiners in Canada. And of course, as we all know, that plastic winds up in the Great Lakes and in fish and in our bodies and everywhere else.
That's a great point. Thanks for bringing that up. You know, one thing that I love about your Substack, again, called The Current, is how you give some outstanding historical background and a breakdown on how Line 5 made its way through parts of Michigan back in the 1950s. And in one of your recent posts, you detailed, and this is something I didn't know, so thanks for writing this. I want you to talk about it just a bit. Something I didn't know is how farmers along Lake Huron, I guess, like in Tuscola and Bay Counties, fought against the construction of Line 5. And in fact, you wrote how Line 5 has always been a matter of the Canadian use of Michigan land for Canadian purpose. That was a quote there. So can you talk more about that history of Michigan farmers arguing back then how this would not benefit them or Michigan in a real meaningful way?
Yeah, and thanks for taking interest in that. I mean, one of the reasons I'm interested in the history of Line 5, I'm writing a book about the history of Line 5, and I should say there are kind of two major points to the book. One is that the disaster that is Line 5 is not something that simply exists as a kind of imminent spill yet to come, but a long ongoing 70-year disaster that's taken multiple forms over the course of the life of the pipeline. And the second point is that I was interested in your question about the sort of movement to shut down Line 5, which I call the modern movement, because there was lots of resistance to the pipeline when it was built in the 1950s. And there are instances of various kinds of resistance that have taken place since that time. And one of them, as you point out, were farmers in the Thumb region who objected to the taking of their land for the laying of this pipeline. And after the Michigan Public Service Commission in the 50s gave its approval to build that line, that gave the company the power of eminent domain so they could take people's land and use it to acquire easements to lay the pipeline. And the farmers there resisted in a number of different ways. First of all, they were displeased with the amount that they were to be compensated for the laying of that pipeline. And I think they were pretty savvy. They recognized that oil transportation is a pretty remunerative endeavor for pipeline companies. And they were asked to give their land for a pittance in relation to that. But they also objected to the idea that the pipeline company at that time, they were called Lakehead Pipeline, that they were not transporting Michigan oil to Michigan markets. They recognized that this was the foreign use of their land that wasn't going to bring much, if any, benefit to them or to the state of Michigan. And that's still an argument that folks are making in the public sphere and in the courts today. I think it's interesting, too, that it is an argument that has a 70-year history that's as old as the pipeline. Those farmers were pretty sharp and understood much more than simply the destruction that might take place on their land, the way that they would be taken advantage of by a foreign corporation. But they also understood who the pipeline was going to benefit and who the pipeline was not going to benefit. And the not is, by and large, citizens of the state of Michigan. And that's still true today.
That's interesting. So let's fast forward then a bit, since you touched on it already, about the modern movement then to close down Line 5. Maybe you could just give everybody a brief review of some events that happened that got that movement started.
As I said, after the spill in 2010, people got interested in other activities and pipelines that Enbridge operates in the area. And one of the first kind of public statements about this pipeline was a report that was put together by some folks from the National Wildlife Federation called Sunken Hazard. And what that report did was simply notify people publicly of the existence of the pipeline and the danger that it poses because of the possibility of a rupture in the Great Lakes, most especially. And so some other folks, reading that report and becoming concerned, organized themselves into a coalition. Sometimes it was just individuals, but there was also a group formed that held a rally in 2012, if I have my date right, up at the Straits that they called Oil and Water Don't Mix. And that brought together a bunch of citizens of Michigan, activists, people from environmental organizations, and maybe even most especially tribal groups. And the great Bill McKibben came and spoke. And in some ways, that was the kind of public inauguration of the shutdown Line 5 movement. And it's been pretty amazing to watch it grow over the course of a decade. It seemed at that time, I think, to most of us who were paying attention to it, a kind of fantasy or dream that one could shut down a pipeline. But it has pretty quickly become a significant and ongoing political and legal issue in the state of Michigan. So the best example of that is after Gretchen Whitmer was elected governor back in 2018 and Dana Nessel was elected attorney general, the pressure applied by all the folks that I've just described got them to take action. And Dana Nessel filed a suit to get the line shut down and Governor Whitmer revoked the easement for them to operate the pipeline on the Straits bottomland. And of course, Enbridge has fought those in the courts and it's been mired in legal proceedings ever since.
And just to go back to that time, I mean, they kind of had to make those moves, Governor Whitmer and Attorney General Nessel, right when they got into office, because this tunnel project became a law after then Governor and Republican Rick Snyder and the MAGA Republican majority in the Michigan legislature passed the project during the lame duck session, I think, back in 2018, just before Whitmer and Nessel took their offices. And I guess the way I look at that now, and I remember when I was in radio out in Saginaw reporting on this daily, it seemed like to me the whole goal was to thwart any kind of action that Whitmer, Nestle, the new administration coming in, any moves that they could really do to shut down the pipeline or at least make sure that it all went to the courts and just stifle the entire movement to shut it down. Is that a good reading on how all that took place?
It's a great reading, and thanks for bringing up that component of the issue. You know, Enbridge has a long history of currying favor with politicians in this state, and they wield the kind of power that all these big corporations wield over legislatures and legislators at every level of government. And they lobbied the Snyder administration hard, and they lobbied the Republican legislators in Michigan hard. And out of that came what I think is a ruse that so many have fallen for to build this tunnel. The solution to concerns that people have for safety, or so the story goes from Enbridge and the Michigan Republicans at that time, was to take those two twin pipelines that are sitting at the bottom of the straits, build a brand new concrete tunnel deep in the bedrock of the straits, and put a new pipeline, single pipeline, inside of that. It sounds like a great idea, I suppose, in theory, but I think it's really kind of a trick. I'm not convinced that Enbridge wants to build that tunnel. It's $1 billion, 10-year or more investment that doesn't make any financial sense right now. It's just been a clever delay tactic that so many people, decision makers in the state, have fallen for because it sounds like a solution to the problem of a potential spill in the straits. I mean, it's very clever because in some ways it did tie the hands of a lot of people in positions of authority because it has the force of law. And so it's been going through the process of approval ever since. And it's made it difficult to find ways to prevent the construction of the tunnel.
Just let that be a lesson to some that you can use your power of the majority in lame duck session. Anyway, that's just as an aside. Let's fast forward if you don't mind, just to the recent news, because this is really why I wanted to get you on, is because we've got some real important developments that happened regarding the battle to shut this whole Line 5 down. And I'm talking about the Trump regime's fast tracking of this tunnel project to go through the Straits of Mackinac that you just described. And Trump is designating this as an emergency, if I'm not mistaken, and that is basically giving everything that Enbridge kind of wanted in a way. Can you explain more exactly what Trump did here over the last week or so?
Sure. Among Trump's many unhinged executive orders was the declaration of what they're calling, his administration is calling, a national energy emergency, which bears very little relation to reality. We don't have a national energy emergency. There was more energy production in the United States during the Biden administration than we'd seen for years. But because the Trump administration is beholden to the fossil fuel industry, they declared this national emergency that is supposed to open up and facilitate energy production and transportation in any number of ways. And so that includes fast tracking various kinds of permitting processes. And that has to do with the building of new pipelines, with extracting new energy and on federal lands. And there are a lot of places where this national emergency declaration can come into play. And among them is the tunnel, because before the tunnel can be built, it needs approval from the United States Army Corps of Engineers because of the discharge of water into wetlands, and that falls under the Clean Water Act. And the Army Corps of Engineers had agreed prior to the new administration to do a full environmental impact assessment for that project, and that's an extended, laborious, important process. Under the emergency order, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has agreed to truncate, to shorten that process significantly. We don't yet have details exactly what they will or will not do, but they're going to hurry it up. And they're not going to do their due diligence in the way that they had promised to do prior to this declaration. And I'll say one other thing about this, that it's typical of the Trump administration that the fast tracking of this particular project is incoherent and nonsensical, even on the terms of the Trump administration's policies. If they want to, as they say, unleash American energy, what they're doing here is exactly the opposite. They're facilitating Canadian energy by helping to build this tunnel to continue Line 5's operations.
Which is strange, because I remember when we were talking about all these tariffs. We have to place these NAFTA tariffs on Canada. We can do that because we don't need Canada for anything. Yet, yeah. For some reason, though, when it comes to Enbridge and Line 5, oh, yeah, sure, we can deal with Canada.
Which is typical of the capricious and incoherent policies of this administration.
Very, very true. While I have you here, too, you did a great job talking about this one individual in one of your pieces. And I was wondering if you could just bring it up, because I just think it is another shining example of how Trump is always a transactional president, sometimes maybe above everything else. Can you talk about this Tim Barnard?
Oh, sure. So one of the contractors that Enbridge has hired to help build their tunnel is a contractor who has very close ties to the Trump administration. He's given hundreds of thousands of dollars to the election of Donald Trump. And so once again, and in certain kinds of ways, like this shouldn't be surprising to us at all, that one of the reasons that one can assume Trump has agreed, despite his policies to facilitate domestic production and transportation of fossil fuels, to give a freebie to a Canadian corporation is because it's also giving a freebie to one of his donors, this guy who owns Barnard Construction, who's a longtime supporter of the Republican Party and of the Trump administration in particular. It's a kind of giveaway to a donor, which is like the very definition of a kind of transactional decision on the part of the president.
Right. And we just see that all of the time. It happened in the first time he was in office, and we're already seeing it obviously happen here early on. And we're even seeing with tariffs on who gets carve outs and who doesn't in certain industries. Just two more questions, if you don't mind. You know, in your latest post on The Current, you really didn't mince words. Kind of sounded like me a little bit, too, in your criticisms and disappointment of Governor Whitmer's handling of that White House visit that she had in the Oval Office there with Trump a few weeks ago. And I think you used that disastrous photo of her covering her face with her folder as kind of a metaphor on how she's been hiding during the whole issue of Line 5 here for the last few years. You brought up how right out of the gate she was making some moves, but in the last few years, can't say that she's really done a whole lot. Now, she alone, the governor, cannot shut down Line 5, obviously, of course, but you say that she could still play a pivotal role in part of this battle. How so?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of different ways that she could play a pivotal role. And it is the case. To my disappointment, as someone who had high hopes for her and supported her and has always wanted her to be the kind of progressive governor that I think lots of us expected after her election in 2018. But yeah, she's sort of gone silent. And I think there are a lot of reasons for that, which I suppose we could talk about. But she's got a chance here to help. I think there are a couple of ways that she could help. One is simply by using the bully pulpit, that in lots of ways, the growth and the strength of the Line 5 movement has had a lot to do with changing people's minds in the public sphere. And as governor, especially as someone now with a national profile, she's got a pretty big megaphone. And instead of being quiet, which I think is probably for political reasons, she could step up and help us understand what's at stake here a little more clearly, especially with regard to protection of the Great Lakes. But secondly, and more practically, what she can do is that she can direct the EGLE, the Department of Energy, Great Lakes, and Environment, to do a full and complete environmental assessment of the kind that we think the U.S. Army Corps is no longer going to do. And that would give opportunity, among other things, for much more of a public voice, for a lot more tribal consultation, to have their say in deciding whether EGLE gets to grant yet another permit to approve the tunnel project as well. So I think those are the two big things that she could do.
Do you have theories as to why she hasn't been as forceful or been upfront when it comes to Line 5 as she was, you know, when she first got in office?
You're asking me to be a political pundit now. I mean, I'll say one thing. I mean, I don't know. I mean, you know, I don't wear that hat very comfortably. But I mean, well, there's two reasons. One, labor, I think, that the unions have been understandably, but also I think misguidedly in favor of the tunnel because it promises some construction jobs. I have a lot to say about the reality of the prospects for construction jobs for union workers in Michigan. But nevertheless, that's one reason. And secondly, I just think she's running for president. She's been running for president for 3 years now.
Could President Biden have done more while he was in office on this issue?
He absolutely could have done more. So one of the important components of any cross-border pipeline is that it has to have a presidential permit. You may remember the Keystone XL pipeline controversy from 8 or 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And that hinged upon the granting of a presidential permit for the crossing of the pipeline at the border. And here, this pipeline crosses the international border in Sarnia at the St. Clair River. Biden could have, with a stroke of the pen, revoked that presidential permit for Enbridge to operate that pipeline across the border. He chose not to do so. President Trump could do the same thing. Perversely, that kind of action on his part would be more in line with his domestic policies. But the prospects of him doing that, I think, are pretty dim.
I'd have to agree with you. Oh, there's so much I'd love to talk with you about, but we're running out of time here. But I thank you for everything. Jeffrey Insko, his Substack is called The Current, and he's also a professor of English at Oakland University and is also an author. And wait, when's that book supposed to come out?
I'm finishing it hopefully in the next couple of months, and then, you know, it'll take a while for that, but I hope within the year.
Would you consider coming back on to talk more about it when it's published?
I would love to come back on and talk more about it at any time, Pat.
All right. Well, thank you so much for everything that you're doing, all the great work that you're doing to make sure everyone is informed of what's happening with Line 5. Thanks again for being on.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for all that you do as well.
He enjoys watching sporting events from years ago. He can recite most of the 1984 Detroit Tigers lineup. He will go to the mat in saying Michigan has produced some of the greatest music in the past 60 years. But most of all, he enjoys the loyalty of a fine dog while sipping on a tasty Michigan beer. Oh, and he loves talking about politics, if you haven't been able to tell yet. It's the Left of Lansing podcast with Pat Johnston. Need more Pat? Visit and subscribe to leftoflansing.com. Now, back to Pat.
Thanks again to Professor Insko for sharing his extensive knowledge on the battle on closing the Line 5 pipeline. I will link to his site called The Current wherever you are listening here today, and please check it out. He does a fantastic job on breaking down almost every different angle regarding the fight to close down Line 5. One more thing, by the way, a postscript, if you will. Jeffrey mentioned in his latest writing how this tunnel project to encase Line 5 under the Straits of Mackinac is really something that won't be done for quite some time because Enbridge really doesn't want to do it due to the expense of the project. So we'll keep our eye on the latest surrounding Line 5 and why it must be shut down for the health of our Great Lakes and also for the overall environment, since we can't forget we're supposed to be moving towards a carbon-free economy in the state in the next 15 years. What is the point of Line 5? Time now for the Left of Lansing Last Call. I ran across some stunning news this week, and I'm actually being sincere when I say that. Steve Bannon. Yeah, that's Steve Bannon. You know, Trump's former strategist who went to jail for a while because he defied subpoenas to appear in front of the committee investigating the January 6th insurrection, and who was also under indictment, by the way, for money laundering and fraud, but got a pardon from Dear Leader. Yes, that's Steve Bannon. Well, he's all of a sudden warning Trump and the entire MAGA Republican Party they are risking looking like the party of the rich and the connected, and he says they risk looking like the oligarch party. Okay, well, they've always been the oligarch party, but it's now becoming way too obvious for Americans and even for some Republicans. They're realizing, oh no, we look like we really are just a corporatist party. And so some MAGA types like Bannon are taking notice and are getting a little concerned about it. Because while President Musk is busy gutting health research, Social Security, Head Start education programs, MAGA Republicans in Congress right now are working on passing massive tax cuts for Elon Musk and all of the billionaire donor base, and also for corporations. And it'll also add nearly $7 trillion to the debt for those who get sweaty palms over that stuff. But I always love how the elitists out there always talk about the debt when we want to strengthen the working class safety net, but never when it comes to massive tax breaks for corporations. I wonder why that is. But you see, that's why those rallies by AOC and Bernie are garnering thousands to attend. And that's why all of these indivisible rallies are getting bigger and bigger throughout the country. The people are tired of corporate authoritarianism, and they're tired of the oligarchy running this country into the ground. Why? To satisfy their greed and power. And that's why I asked earlier if Haley Stevens really understands what this fight is about. as she's supposedly fighting to keep the Democratic Party in the status quo. No changes in the party. She doesn't think the party needs any kind of changes, whether it be on leadership or messaging. But back to Steve Bannon here. He's urging Dear Leader to insist on a millionaire tax by having the top tax rate go back to its 2017 level of 39%. I think it's around 37% right now. So why is Bannon doing this? Because whenever a progressive Democrat puts out such a policy, Republicans always wave their finger and say, you're going to kill jobs. But why is Bannon doing this? Because he sees how effective progressive messaging is on this issue. He sees it, and he also sees how effective and popular this message is with the working class. And he also sees how Trump's numbers are taking a nosedive when it comes to the economy. So Bannon says if Republicans pass such a bill, it'll disarm people like AOC, Bernie, and this popular progressive policy. I think that's his main motivation. He is seeing that it's working. But don't worry, everybody. Don't worry. I mean, do you really think Republican Michigan congresspeople like, let's say, John James, Lisa McClain, Jack Bergman, Bill Huizenga, or my congressman, the human pylon, John Molinar, would have the guts to tax their own corporate masters like the DeVos family? Don't bet on it. Perhaps that's why we must insist, though, on anyone running for office, be it in Congress or statewide seats or state legislature seats, that they be in favor of the millionaire tax to help pay for working class programs and to make the system just a little bit fairer for everyone. It's really not that hard to do, but yet for some Democrats, it sadly is.
You're listening to the Left of Lansing podcast. The music you're hearing is by Wander Beats. To hear the latest project, check out Space Leopard on your favorite streaming site. Now back to our favorite progressive voice in Michigan, it's Pat Johnston.
Well, that's going to do it for this edition of The Left of Lansing. Follow me on Blue Sky, Twitter, Facebook, the Gram, and on YouTube. I'm posting some more video shorts on there, so please check them out and subscribe to the show there as well. And Congresswoman Stevens, the door is always open for you to appear here on the show, and we could talk about things. And I always aim to be fair, and if you think I'm way, way off base, just tell me. So the door is always open to you. You know, it's supposed to be 80 degrees in mid-Michigan on Thursday, which means I might have to have my first homemade frozen strawberry margarita, which I have to tell you, and I'm going to brag a little bit, is far better than anything that you can get at some chain restaurant. Promise me, my recipe, second to none. And judging by how the news cycle's been here the last few months, I may need two of them. Until next time, remember, take the battle to them. Thank you, Michigan!
The Left of Lansing podcast was produced by Pat Johnston, written by Pat Johnston, researched by Pat Johnston, edited by Pat Johnston, and hosted by, yes, Pat Johnston. Technical assistance by Dr. Heather. And thanks to our good friend Kirsten for the awesome podcast logo. Remember to visit leftoflansing.com for more news and information. Thanks again for listening to the Left of Lansing podcast.